Environmentalism. No matter your perspective on it, you have to agree, it's everywhere. Many years after Kermit the Frog first sang about how it wasn't easy being green, it's become less easy not to be green. If you're not being environmentally friendly, you're at least pretending to be environmentally friendly. No matter how cynical you want to get, every corporate attempt at greenwashing suggests something about what people value. But it hasn't always been this way. As recently as the 1960s, smoke-spitting factories were seen as symbols of progress and prosperity, not pollution. In Pittsburgh, which was choked with fumes from steel mills, you could buy postcards of the city that touted its air quality as a sign of economic vitality. In the 1970s, over the span of just a few years, all of this changed, at least in America. Under President Richard Nixon, of all people, the EPA was created, the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts were passed, and millions of Americans participated in the first Earth Day, the largest protest in American history as a share of the population, until the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. How did we get there? What brought us to this social change? If you look this question up, you'll often find a clear answer. The 1969 fire on the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio. It was so clogged with oil and chemicals from Cleveland's many industries that there was a gluey sheen several feet thick on top of the water, and all it took was a spark from a freight train on a bridge above the river to ignite it. The fire was photographed by journalists from Time magazine and sparked a national outcry. Americans were so shocked to discover that a river could catch fire that they organized for stronger laws governing the environment, and as a result, we have the environmental movement as we know it today. The narrative here has been repeated by National Geographic, Time magazine itself, and the website Ohio History Central, which A, is about the saddest name for a website I've ever seen, and B, implies the existence of a wilder, more conspiratorial Ohio History Peripheral. But the common narrative of the 1969 Cuyahoga fire as the spark that lit the flame of environmentalism is largely built on a myth, and what isn't a myth is hugely exaggerated. As is pointed out by the Smithsonian and the site clevelandhistorical.org, which I like to imagine has a bloody rivalry with Ohio History Central passed down through generations, the 1969 fire was minor, and it wasn't even the first time the Cuyahoga had caught fire. The 1969 fire may loom large in the American psyche today, but it attracted not that much attention when it happened. So how did it become seen as the starting block from which America's environmental consciousness was launched? The fire barely got much media coverage in Cleveland itself at the time. So how is it so well known today that it inspired songs by Randy Newman and R.E.M. and even got referenced in the 2010s in a clip on the Important Videos playlist?
See our river that catches on fire. It's so polluted that all our fish have AIDS.
And of course, if it wasn't the Cuyahoga River fire, what convinced the country to care about the environment? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. June 22, 1969, Cleveland, Ohio. The Stonewall Riots, another incident that grew in historical standing long after it happened, and one that can more accurately be said to have sparked a movement, are a week off from happening in New York. The moon landing will happen in a month. Woodstock in 2 more months. Charles Manson and the Zodiac Killer are at large in California. In Cleveland, another ordinary day is beginning. Everyone in Cleveland knows that the Cuyahoga is polluted. 2 years ago, the city elected Carl Stokes, the first black mayor of a major American city, on a platform that included river cleanup. Voters passed a $100 million bond initiative to clean the Cuyahoga, but to the thousands who work in the steel mills and freight depots along the river shore, they can tell that isn't doing too well. The river bubbles like a witch's brew. Dead rats, inflated to the size of dogs by decomposition, float past steel workers unloading iron ore from barges, who are warned that if they fall in with the rats, they'll go straight to the hospital. Around noon, a freight train on the Norfolk and Western Railway line crosses the river, throwing sparks off the rusty old bridge. To nobody's surprise, this ignites the ubiquitous oil slick on the surface of the river. A single fireboat from the Cleveland Fire Department and one land-based firefighter battalion arrive. They successfully put out the fire in less than 30 minutes, and the average day's commerce resumes on the Cuyahoga River. A few reporters from the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper head on down to the river to document the fire, the way local news crews document any other small fire in a big city, as a bit of filler to pad out a slow news day. They're too late to witness anything. By the time they arrive, it's been extinguished, and a single paragraph article runs in the next day's Plain Dealer, informing Cleveland residents that once again, the Cuyahoga has caught fire. No photos are believed to exist of the fire. Assertions that the flames shot up 5 stories are unsourced and probably refer to earlier fires on the Cuyahoga. Nobody is injured, and the full extent of damage consists of $50,000 worth of repairs on the railroad bridge, which, even then, really isn't that much. The main focus of the paltry news coverage isn't that the river burned, but that the railroad bridge will be out of service for a few days, snarling train traffic in the area. And if Clevelanders noticed the news article about the fire at all they probably thought was, well, it could have been a lot worse. Indeed, the Cuyahoga had suffered much larger fires in 1952, 1948, 41, 36, 1922, 1912, 1867, 1883, and those are only the fires big enough to cause property damage. There were probably a few small fires a year, and one on the scale of the 1969 one was probably about an annual occurrence. The Cuyahoga was probably the city's biggest fire hazard. Absolutely nobody was shocked into realizing the toll humans were taking on the environment by this routine fire on the Cuyahoga River. Nor were water pollution fires just a Cleveland thing. Every other major city with industrial ports had a problem with oily rivers and bays catching fire. Baltimore, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Houston, Buffalo, and Los Angeles all had protocols for this kind of thing. In 1921, a massive fire on the Hudson in New York destroyed a Navy frigate. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, wherever there was a city with a river, the river would be used as a dumping ground for all kinds of flammable byproducts, and river fires were seen as bearable consequences of having a thriving industrial economy. So, what was different about the Cuyahoga and the 1969 fire in particular? The mayor of Cleveland was not white. That's an oversimplification, but not by much. The last time Cleveland had attracted nationwide attention was 1967, when Carl Stokes was elected mayor. Some seethed, some celebrated, and the nation was captivated by the prospect of a black person being the mayor of a big city. Journalists flocked to Cleveland, hanging on to every word Stokes said, some hoping that he would be successful and pave the way for later black politicians, others hoping he would fail spectacularly enough to take the civil rights movement down with him. That wasn't a distant prospect. As the most visible black elected official in the nation, the civil rights movement's fortunes were often seen as rising and falling with Carl Stokes's fortunes. June 23rd, 1969. Stokes is a skilled politician, and he knows how to make hay with the vast amount of media attention trained on him. As I've mentioned before, one of the main issues he ran on was reducing pollution in Cleveland. Mostly air pollution, but water pollution as well, even though, at the time, that was considered a narrow issue. Stokes didn't want to make his tenure as mayor all about race, and would rather have used the attention his race drew and refocused that attention on what he saw as Cleveland's real issues. The day after the 1969 fire, Stokes realized that the damaged train bridge would make a good backdrop for a press conference on Cleveland's water pollution, guaranteed to get a decent audience because the press lapped up every word he said. Minor structural damage from a river fire was a pretty ordinary sight along the Cuyahoga, but Stokes tries to say that it shouldn't be. The Cuyahoga had been smoldering for over a century, but Clevelanders and Americans at large needed to realize how unnatural this is. Rivers aren't supposed to catch fire. Distant as the idea may seem, he says, it's possible to build a world where a river burning is a surprise. Stokes takes reporters on a tour of the overflowing sewers and howling factories that line the river banks, and tells them that a lot of this isn't in his power to regulate. The city of Cleveland can't do much on its own to mandate water cleanliness because the Cuyahoga flows through so many cities and unincorporated areas, there's no point source of pollution that can be put under control without an unlikely alliance. Change, Stokes says, needs to come from the federal level. Stokes's color wasn't the only reason he was able to nationalize Cleveland politics. In fact, his circumstances made him an ideal figurehead for combating urban issues in 1960s America. He was knee-deep in press coverage because of his status as a racial pioneer, but he also had connections in D.C. through his brother, Lewis, who served in the House seat for the Cleveland metro area as one of the first black U.S. representatives in Ohio. In practice, the Stokes brothers were effectively both mayor of Cleveland and both Cleveland's House member. Carl would regularly accompany Louis to Washington, D.C. to lobby the government on issues facing Cleveland, as well as industrial cities across the nation. August 1st, 1969. The country is coming off a momentous few weeks, both good and bad. Everyone knows one of the two things that happened in late July 1969.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But there was another big news story right around the same time. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, the last of the Kennedy brothers still in politics after John and Robert's assassinations, and a leading candidate for the presidency in 1972, had been involved in a car accident on Massachusetts' Chappaquiddick Island, which had killed a 28-year-old woman alleged to be his mistress. Kennedy had been driving drunk. It was about the worst scandal a politician could imagine, and Americans were hungry for further details. Naturally, in the pre-internet age, people rushed to buy print media, and that week's edition of Time magazine, covering both the return of the Apollo astronauts to Earth and the aftermath of the Chappaquiddick scandal, became one of the most read issues in the magazine's history. But because of Carl and Louis Stokes' attempt at publicizing water pollution in Cleveland and beyond, that edition of Time also included a brief piece on the most recent Cuyahoga River fire, as part of Time's launch of a new environment section. With no photos of the 1969 fire to work with, Time's editors unearthed a photo of the much more serious 1952 fire, a dramatic scene showing the entire river engulfed in flames, surrounding a boat on all sides. Firefighters spray water from a bridge overhead. This photo got published without any caption at all, and no indication that it came from 1952. Today, this photo is still usually misidentified as being the 1969 fire. The millions of Americans who bought the August 1st issue of Time to read about Apollo and Ted Kennedy saw the striking photo of the Cuyahoga on fire, had no reason to believe it wasn't from earlier that summer, and came away realizing that water pollution may not be a trivial issue after all. What happens next is not really related to the Cuyahoga fire, but it would be wrong to say the sensationalistic media coverage of the fire has nothing to do with what's beginning to happen. The next year, Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, whose name was Gaylord Nelson, organized the first Earth Day in April 1970, which became the largest protest America had ever seen, with the assistance of powerful union leader Walter Reuther. In Cleveland, thousands of students marched down to the banks of the Cuyahoga. By now a local symbol of environmental degradation, but not much more. Carl Stokes steps down as mayor in 1971 to join his brother in lobbying for federal environmental laws. While the Stokes brothers are largely remembered today for their support for the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, Carl did often express his fears that environmental laws would stifle industry and attempts to reduce the wealth gap, because there was still a strong association between dirty industry and economic vitality. As a new issue in the political arena, the environment hadn't settled along left and right political lines the way it was today. The strongest proponent of the environment in 1970 may have been Republican President Nixon. He dedicated a third of his 1970 State of the Union address to the environment, and later that year, in response to Gaylord Nelson's Earth Day protests, Nixon created the EPA, which most of the Senate voted for. In 1972, the Stokes brothers' labors were rewarded by the passage of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, which included poverty alleviation clauses at their request. The latter act mandated that every river in the United States must be safe enough to swim and fish in by 1983, a goal that seemed nearly impossible at the time, but came pretty close to being reached. I once had a professor who tried to argue that Nixon was actually one of the most liberal presidents America ever had, and while that guy was definitely just trying to stir the pot and say something unpopular, I see what he was getting at. I don't think there's been a president before or since who has passed so much landmark environmental legislation. Over the next few years, people looked back and thought, how did this happen? How did we get so much environmental progress so quickly? As the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts faded further and further into the past, and America's city skies and urban rivers gradually became cleaner, a narrative took hold that clearly the environment must have reached a breaking point around 1969, when people became fed up. America must have been getting filthier and filthier until then, people believe now, and looking for a specific turning point that energized the nation, people who were alive in the 60s remember seeing the inaccurate photo of the blazing Cuyahoga in Time magazine. People who were in Congress around then might remember being approached by the Stokes brothers, soliciting votes for the Clean Water Act, leaning heavily into stories of the Cuyahoga's woes in their hometown. The burning Cuyahoga River began showing up in speeches and editorials about the environment around the country. With Nixon's environmental laws being largely successful, the prospect of a river burning became unheard of, an almost biblically apocalyptic world-turned-upside-down moment, and the Cuyahoga fire began to be remembered as a much larger event than it was. Inaccurate stories of the fire are all over the place, sometimes reinforced by people's false memories. A recent study found that almost everyone who was growing up in Cleveland in the 60s now has a memory of having witnessed the fire, or at least witnessing news coverage of it, even though very few people were actually on site when it happened, and it wasn't a major news story until months after the fact. A 1990s book about Lake Erie and its recovery describes the Cuyahoga River as several linear miles went up in flames, which never happened even when the Cuyahoga had its more serious fires, and in 2008, when Randy Newman was asked about the origin of his song Burn On, he said he wrote it after seeing the Cuyahoga burning on the nightly news. No TV news footage is believed to have ever been taken of any fire on the Cuyahoga. Which really shows the power of a media narrative, right? If you tell people that they should have remembered the 1969 fire as unique and shocking, they will. But regardless of its media attention or lack thereof, it wasn't the culmination of an America that was getting more and more polluted, either. The last big fire on the Cuyahoga was in 1952. Before that, there was a bad fire just 4 years previously in 1948, and before that in 1941. The 1940s and 50s were the banner years for river fires in America, if we're going off the number and severity of fires. So the 1969 fire wasn't the peak of the degradation of America's rivers, but the last gasp of an era in which rivers were much more polluted than they were both in 1969 and today. America had started to deindustrialize by 1969, after all. Jobs were beginning to be shipped overseas, factories were beginning to automate. There weren't as many industries to foul the water as there had been just a few years before. And that had other effects on people. So that's a brief summary of how the Cuyahoga River story became so well known and how it wasn't the source of the American environmental movement. But then what was? If the Cuyahoga fire was just an example of historical retconning to provide a cute narrative, why did America suddenly begin caring so much about the environment in the 60s? Well, there was a lot of political upheaval in the 60s, obviously. I should probably play footage of an anti-Vietnam War march or The Times They Are a-Changin' by Bob Dylan, but those are just so cliched you can just imagine them in your head as I talk to you. But anti-war movements and black civil rights demonstrations and everything had been happening for decades. They just reached critical mass in the 60s. The environmental movement came out of nowhere. A few sources have put down America's newfound fascination with the environment around then to another major thing that was happening in the 60s, the space program. Just 6 months before the 1969 Cuyahoga fire, in December 1968, the crew of Apollo 8, who orbited the moon but didn't land on it, snapped a photo they called Earthrise, of the Earth half in shadow, rising above the moon's surface. Broadcast on TV, Americans and humans worldwide saw Earth from space for the first time ever, giving some a newfound sense of appreciation for the fragility of their home. People began to look around them and notice what they were doing to the planet. In the words of astronaut William Anders, who took the photo, "We set out to explore the moon, and instead we discovered the Earth." The most famous photo of Earth from space, the Blue Marble, was taken later in 1972, and it's still used as a symbol of peace and environmentalism, so there's something to that. But there's another possibility. In 1962, marine biologist Rachel Carson released a nonfiction book called Silent Spring, detailing the effect of pesticides on America's fish, bird, and insect populations. Written after years of research on the chemical industry, during which Carson had contracted breast cancer, possibly related, possibly not, Silent Spring got rave reviews. Just the year before, the reproductive drug thalidomide had been discovered to cause birth defects, and America was becoming increasingly suspicious of the chemical industry. On the heels of Silent Spring's success, Carson appeared before President Kennedy and the Science Advisory Committee, and recommended a ban on the pesticide DDT and the creation of a federal agency tasked with managing the environment, exactly what Nixon would later establish. Some of the world's most visible environmentalists, like Al Gore and David Attenborough, credit Silent Spring with influencing them to care about the environment, and probably so do millions of others. Kennedy's scientists found that most of her conclusions about pesticides' effect on the ecosystem were correct. So, if it wasn't the Cuyahoga River fire that sparked America's environmental movement in the 60s, what was it? There's the Earthrise photo, there's Silent Spring, but there is another possibility. Americans were having the shit scared out of them about the environment in the 60s, largely due to a guy named Paul Ehrlich. Climate change deniers love Paul Ehrlich. A Stanford biologist in the 60s, Ehrlich became nationally famous for predicting the impending collapse of society due to unsustainable population growth, and a few decades later, became famous for being completely wrong about everything and refusing to admit it. His 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, began with the words, "The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate." And he really meant this, and it seemed really believed it. He predicted that in the 1970s, 1 billion deaths would occur as a result of famine. Hundreds of millions would be Americans. The world could not support any more people than the 3 billion it had on it at the time, and pretty soon, we were all headed for disaster. This captivated America. Ehrlich was a vivid writer and a skilled publicist of his own work, regularly appearing on the Johnny Carson Show. He was a true household name. The Population Bomb sold millions of copies, alongside other pop science bestsellers that predicted a bleak environmental future for the world, including a book called Famine! 1975! America's Decision, Who Will Survive? Which, I can't help but read it like this. Famine! 1975, America's decision, who will survive? Famine!
1975, America's decision, who will survive?
The idea of a materially starved future began taking hold in the American psyche, with movies like Soylent Green reinforcing the idea that before long there will be too many people and not enough food. In 1971, the sci-fi great Ursula K. Le Guin wrote the book The Lathe of Heaven, set in Portland in 2002. Her depiction of Portland in 2002 was about as populated as Portland really is today, except that a substantial percentage of the city, in her imagination, lived in a perpetual state of malnourishment, with children suffering from the disease kwashiorkor, really only seen in major famines in Africa. And before you say, I wish we'd listened to Paul Ehrlich back then, keep listening. Population growth did happen, in fact, a little bit faster than he predicted. He said we would reach 6 billion people by the end of the 20th century. By then, it was close to 7 billion. But the consequences of population growth turned out to be miles away from what he expected. India, a country long wracked by famines, hasn't had a serious food shortage in decades. The percentage of the global population that's malnourished has been cut in half. There are fewer food insecure people on the planet in sheer numbers today than there were in Ehrlich's time, which is impressive given that there's more than twice as many people. All these years later, Ehrlich is still around, still promoting his long debunked credo about how population growth will doom us all to famine. This is why climate change deniers love Paul Ehrlich. He's a perfect straw man, a debunked the end is near soothsayer who refuses to admit he's wrong. He's the perfect example of the sort of guy who tells you he's got a woolly mammoth in his garage, then when you ask to see it, he says it's an invisible mammoth, then when you say you'll scatter some flour on the floor so you can see its footprints, he says it's a hovering mammoth, then when you say, well, I'll just shave off some of its invisible fur as a souvenir, he says it's the non-woolly kind of woolly mammoth, and so on until you eventually get him to admit that all he has in his garage is the idea of a woolly mammoth in his head. But he will never admit to have misled you. So, Paul Ehrlich, for a time, may have influenced Americans to start caring more about the environment, but scaring the shit out of people is a really bad strategy, and I'm hard-pressed to believe that we got the EPA because of the population bomb. If you begin a book by saying we're all screwed and there's nothing we can do about it, how likely is that to move you to action? I'm a bit more given to believe there's a much broader reason why Americans began caring about the environment in the 60s, possibly so obvious it was never really noticed at all. Deindustrialization. It's not like Americans suddenly realized that burning rivers were a bad thing in the 60s. It's not like people weren't coughing on urban air pollution and couldn't smell that their water was toxic. It's just that before the 60s, those were seen as unfortunate consequences of a positive process, the existence of well-paying factory jobs. Who would want to complain about the refuse of the place that gives you a job? But as the 20th century went on, automation began to take hold in American factories, and East Asian economies began to catch up to the United States. The percentage of Americans employed in the industrial sector went down steadily from the end of World War II onward. With most Americans no longer deriving economic benefit from industrial areas, they began to look at industry with a more skeptical eye. If machines are doing all the work people used to, pollution is no longer a sign of prosperity, it's just adding insult to injury. Pollution had been all around Americans all the time, but only in the 60s did they decide they no longer needed to give industries a free pass. And what of the state of America's environment today? The Clean Air and Clean Water Acts were hugely successful. Today, the old industrial areas along the Cuyahoga in Cleveland are full of thriving bars and condos, although Ohio continues to suffer from the loss of the manufacturing jobs that it never got back. In 2019, a whole 50 years after the Cuyahoga last caught fire, the state of Ohio declared fish caught in the river safe to eat, an amazing turnaround for a river that, in the 1970s, had almost no life in it whatsoever. I'm pretty sick of our long national sense of doom about the environment. You can look into the Cuyahoga River today, where oil slicks used to spark and smolder, and realize that we've successfully restored the environment in America before, and we can do it again.